name's Christiane, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, Christiane.
Hi, and I want to say happy birthday to everyone tonight who had a birthday. I'm inspired, and I just want to say ditto, because I always get really emotional when I hear people taking their cakes. It's overwhelming, and it's beautiful, and welcome to the newcomers. I'm in awe by your courage to come back, to come here. If it were up to me to get sober here, it wouldn't have happened. God knew he had to lay my ass down, you know, put an electric fence around me for quite some time before I could get sober. I couldn't do it out here. So I have a great deal of admiration for all of you that could. That takes a great deal of strength. And it keeps me coming back and keeps me sober. So thank you so much. And I want to thank you for allowing me to be of service. It's always perfect timing. I'm so grateful I'm not drinking during menopause because I would have never survived that. Thank God for small favors. I'm telling you, ladies, you made it just in time because that wouldn't have been pretty. really, seriously, I was thinking that tonight, what am I most grateful for? And that is, like, today, one of the most grateful things that I was sober during menopause. So what it was like, it was really dark and a lot of fun. For many of us, we kind of have things happen in our lives, especially when we're a lot younger, you know, things that we can't explain, and it could be different for each and every one of us, but the pain we feel and the lack of support and everything that happens inside of us, there's so many similarities to that, the feelings of insecurity and self-judgment and shame. And for me, I try to explain some of the things that happened to me when I was younger. It wasn't something that just broke my heart, because I can survive that. It's, you know, some things like fractured my soul, and that's the only way I can explain it. And there's been a couple times in my life where I have found true freedom. I mean, true freedom. And the first one was when I was 14, when I started drinking. And I still, you know, I'm almost 50, so it's been a few years, and I can't remember where I left my glasses or my keys, but I sure remember the freedom I felt after that first drink. I felt comfortable in my own skin. I could be around other human beings and not be a complete psycho bitch and really insecure. I could dance. That was always a perk. Or I thought I could. But, you know, when you're drinking, you know, you can do just about anything with my, you know, cape and wings. But, yeah, there was a freedom with that first night. You know, I had, you know, a few drinks. I was taken to this kegger, and it was just... it was like an out-of-body experience, and it wasn't okay in my body with the self-loathing and the guilt and the shame. And unfortunately, that was a crazy night, but it felt so good that I had to have more. I had to have more of that freedom, and that's what alcohol was. It was that freedom every time I drank, and it felt so good. And that's sometimes the scary part of it. And that's, you know, it's, we talk about in the program, more will be revealed, and sometimes it's like, really? You know, I've been here 90 days, everything's freaking fine now. You know, everything should be perfect, and Skittle and rainbows fly out my ass. I know. I guess if you're standing behind me, it could be. But, so, it's amazing some of the awarenesses that come up for me, even after 20 years of sobriety. It's like being a newcomer all over again. And those awarenesses that come forward. And I have to keep coming back, and I have to stay grounded in the program. Because if I don't, I can think I'm healed and I'm okay. And being mindful of everything that happened to me. And the fear of, I can sensationalize it and make it great. I can say, I had a great time, and I looked really good, and I felt so free. I forget about the darkness, and I remember the freedom. And after time, it's really easy to remember that freedom. And it's like, sometimes, even in recovery, I had one of my trainers, when I was seeking my certification in substance abuse counseling, tell me, you know, it gets worse before it gets worse. Then it gets better. And I find that in everything in life. In recovery, continuing in recovery, it gets worse before it gets worse. But then it gets a whole lot better. And there was a time when I thought the promises were far out of my reach. You know, that's for other people. It was like reading, you know, a Disney fairy tale. Yeah, that sounds really pretty, but that's not for me. Because I still carried a lot of the shame and the game. That wasn't a Freudian slip. And the insecurities. I still had all those character defects, and I really thought when I stopped drinking, it would all magically disappear. And it didn't. It didn't. I had many jobs. I was born and raised in Santa Barbara, and I was somewhat of a stuck-up white girl. I swore I wouldn't cuss, so I'm really trying hard not to use those words. Because I like to cuss sometimes. Just, you know, it really makes me grounded in my recovery. Let me just tell you how it is. No. I get ghetto sometimes, and it's fun. Don't let this exterior fool you. So I had a lot of jobs, and I did grow up very entitled in Santa Barbara. You know, I came from a pretty good family. You know, we had our crap, but and some of those adult traits became my character defects. And one of the big ones was that whatever happened inside the house, you don't talk about. You pretend like it doesn't happen, no matter what it is. You walk out that door, you shut the door, and you put a smile on your face, and you pretend nothing ever happened, and you just put your head up and you forget about it. You don't talk about it. You don't process about it. You don't find any coping skills for it, unless it's alcohol. So that the freedom from the alcohol came from trying to cope with all that stuff, trying to put that smile on my face, because the only way I could put that smile on my face and keep it on my face is if I drank, because I had no idea how to work through the rest of the stuff. And nobody talked to me, and not because they intended to do harm. They just didn't know any better, because that's what they were taught. That's what they were taught. And my mom didn't drink, and my dad didn't drink, you know, so, but I did. And I consider myself like a dyslexic drunk, because instead of saying no, it was always on. No matter what it was on, whether it be whatever it was, and I use it liberally, anything and everything, and I don't stick to the doctrine, I'm an equal opportunity addict. I have abused alcohol and drugs, people, anger, food, you name it, I abused it. I would find some way, some form to use it as a coping skill to escape whatever pain I thought I was having. And I was a big victim too, so everything was always everybody else's fault. I carried those insecurities and those pains from my childhood into my adulthood, and so everything was still everybody else's fault. Whatever boyfriend I had at the time, it was his fault I cheated on him with his brother, or his dad, or his sister, or, yeah, I was very colorful when I was young. And it wasn't out of a sense of really wanting to do any harm, because never once was it my intention to hurt anybody. I can't say never that I said, well, I didn't want to hurt them, but it was never my intention to really cause that kind of damage. I always just wanted to connect with another human being. Because I couldn't connect with myself, I didn't have a higher power, and I couldn't connect to anybody. So anytime I was around a human, I had to drink, because it was the only way I could feel comfortable around them. And I so wanted that connection. And I went to any length to make that connection. And if you were a gentleman in a bar and you bought me a drink, we were dating. If you bought me a second drink, we were engaged, and you can bet that. And I am an admitted stalker. I know. I'm telling you, it got a little crazy, and I would manipulate things, and I would turn things around, and it was all your fault. I did what I did, and I would damage you, and I would damage everything you owned, and it was all your fault. It was not my fault, and it was not my responsibility. And I had people in my life that enabled me and didn't hold me accountable. And I sure as hell wasn't going to hold myself accountable, because, you know, nothing was my fault. I had a lot of jobs, a lot of jobs. I was really good at BSing my way into anything. And I was really good at quitting right before the shoe dropped. So I didn't get fired, because I knew it was coming. So I'd make up some elaborate scheme. Oh, lying was another one of my addictions. I was really good at that, too, and manipulating. So I would lie or cheat or steal. And drinking was always my go-to. Once drinking, I would, like I said, you know, it was on, and I would be open to any other substance or any other thing around me. And I put myself in some really dangerous situations and thought it was fun. You know, being in the middle of Compton in the middle of the night, driving from Santa Barbara, convincing people for 3 hours I'm not a narc. That was always exciting. It was hard. And because of my drinking, I was very sexually promiscuous, you know, because I wanted that connection with another human being. And while we can term, there's term slut, or, you know, we can label that, but all it was wanting a connection with another human being. Even if it was only for 30 seconds, gentlemen, I still wanted that connection. Sorry, I had to put that plug in. But that was enough for me in that moment. You know, sometimes you got to throw in the humor. That was enough, and I was okay with that. But the sense of shame that came from my behavior and doing what I did compounded all my other problems. And so I continued to live out of that fracture and continued to need more alcohol to find my freedom. When I wasn't drinking, I was very depressed. So I drank. And I did this for a really long time. And another aspect was, you know, like abortions became my form of birth control. Because I had such a lack of self and responsibility, and I could detach from any responsibility. So when I was younger, I got pregnant a lot, which is scary. And I think back on that, and it's like, what were you thinking? It's amazing. When they say the insanity of the disease, they aren't joking. They aren't joking. But in it, all I wanted to do was find love and find somebody who could love me and make me whole. I was looking for someone to fix me and give me that. And they could for, you know, a little while, a night or whatever, but not for very long. And I destroyed a lot of good men. I had some good people in my life that I really took advantage of because I wanted them to fix me and they couldn't. I had to find a way to do that myself, but I didn't get it. I didn't get it. I eventually had a beautiful young daughter when I was 19 years old, and I thought she would save me. I thought finally I'd have somebody in my life that would love me, that I could love, and everything, again, Skittles and rainbows out my ass, everything would be perfect. But one thing I failed to recall was my lack of coping. I didn't heal that fracture. I didn't even admit that fracture. I didn't think I had a problem with anything. Everything was everybody else's problem. So eventually even that went wrong. And she ended up living with my parents when she was about a year and a half old, because I just couldn't do it. A couple months, it was great. After that, I was hitting the bars and leaving her with my grandmother. And I was really good at manipulating things in a way that people would believe me, and I didn't, or I thought, isn't that funny? Even after 20 years, I'm still thinking I'm getting over. I thought that they believed my crap, my BS, you know, and they just let me go. But they tried. But again, it's that adult defects, you know, if they don't talk about it and they don't bring it up, then it doesn't exist. And it wasn't because they didn't love me. It's just, what the hell are you going to do with me? Nothing bad will ever really happen. Nothing bad will ever really happen. And we think that, well, it's not going to happen to me. That's for other people. Bad things happen to other people, not to me. Actually, my last drunk run was up here in Santa Maria. I was really good at reinventing myself, and I'd stop for a little while, and I'd do really good, but there was that fracture, and I didn't know how to live sober. I didn't know how to do it. I couldn't do it. I was completely incapable of living without alcohol, living without that freedom. That was the only way I could do it. So I was doing good for a while, and then I wasn't. And then I wasn't. And you couple alcohol with other substances, and it's over. Now, mind you, I was a garbage truck for lots of other things until I was drinking some tequila out at a ranch, a bull riding ranch out here in the Pomo. Because for some reason, you know, it's... Sometimes I just crack myself up. I came out here to Santa Maria, and I must have seen a movie or something, because for some reason, my focus was married bull riders. And out here, they're like ants. Yeah, I mean, they're everywhere. Those cowboys in those tight pants, it was like on. And you can find them everywhere. Everywhere. So that was like my focus. And so that's what I did. And I met this girl, and we started partying, and she introduced me to crystal meth, and we drank, and that was it. You know, I think the combination of the two, I finally gave myself over completely. I'd been living both sides of the fence until then, and I could fake it sometimes, and I could get out of it, and I can make some excuses and I can worm my way or weasel my way out of whatever it was, but that combination, that was it. I think part of it wasn't so much the combination as I couldn't live on both sides of the fence anymore. I couldn't live inside my fracture and try to be normal on the outside. I couldn't do it. I tried for too long. I tried for too long, and it just didn't work for me. So for 6 weeks, I went on that tirade. 6 weeks. And we did a lot in that 6 weeks, and it was horrible, and I hated it, and I hated her, and I hated her brother. And I put myself in a situation with people that I couldn't stand, but they were all I had left. So it takes a lot of frickin' vodka to love people you can't stand. And I really tried. I drank a lot of vodka and did a lot of drugs and really tried to love them and be okay with it because I didn't think that was, I couldn't go back. There was no possible way I could call my mom or I could call my family. And you know, back then people just didn't talk about addiction. We didn't talk about the beauty of recovery. Now you see ads everywhere. You didn't see an ad for a sober living home or recovery or counseling or support. I mean, that kind of thing, again, wasn't talked about. It was a dirty little secret. So even recovery was a dirty little secret. Even recovery brought shame. So what do you do with that? Well, you just keep getting loaded and you keep getting drunk and you keep drinking that vodka until you just can't anymore. And when I said, is that a bug crawling on my face? Fabulous. Yeah, it's a little spider. Wasn't that lovely? I'm okay with that. Hello, Mother Nature. You always have to be ready for the unexpected. So that 6 weeks, I talk about, I totally immersed myself in that fracture, and I totally, there was nothing else in my life, and I knew that. I gave everything else up. Everything else up. And I have family that lived here, and I took off. I took my truck and my dog and bailed and didn't tell anybody. And at the time, I didn't think too much of it, you know, until later on, you know, really looking back, working the steps, thinking about the damage that I caused them and thinking about the worry and the fear because, you know, now being in recovery and working with other alcoholics and you don't hear from them, you worry. When I was in prison and some of the women wouldn't come back, you'd worry what happened to them. So that 6 week run got me arrested. And in a big, bad way. When I said God laid me down because he really wanted me to listen, he put me on like a permanent timeout. That's exactly what he did. That's exactly what he did. And again, I was the big victim. But I was arrested, and the day I got arrested, and this is one of those things, that there's some things I don't want to forget about my drinking, because I never want to go back there. I think the true definition of insanity for me was that day I got arrested. And I remember it for some reason, there was like the day or two before, I remember praying, or I wasn't even praying, I was just talking to the man. Not that I even believed there was a man, but I was at a point where I was going to talk to somebody, not these knuckleheads around me. And I remember saying, just get me out of this. God, I can't do this anymore. So really be careful what you ask for, because that's exactly what he did. And that day I'm sitting in the El Camino, and it's really peaceful. There was this sense of calm that came over me, and I had this cold Coors Light in my hand. And the next thing I know, I'm surrounded by cop cars. Surrounded, guns pointed at my head, put your hands on the steering wheel, you know, and I've never really experienced that. Guns scare the crap out of me. I might have shot a water gun every now and then, but I'm scared of guns. I'm scared because I'd hurt myself. They scare me, so I'm surrounded. And I'm not thinking that, oh crap, I'm surrounded by the cops, they're pointing guns at me, I better do something. The insanity of my disease took me to a point where I sat there and the only thing that went through my mind was I don't want to spill my beer. 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 I mean, seriously, that was it. I didn't care about anything else. I just didn't know. I don't make me spill my frickin' beer because that will set me off. Now, that will upset me. And, you know, during those days, we kind of have the moments where we go from point A to point B and have no idea what happened in the middle. I don't remember those steps. So they got me in the back of the car. I don't know if they spilled my beer or not. I don't remember. Who knows? So because I was able in the past to flirt my way out of DUIs in Santa Barbara, because it's really easy to manipulate things there. It's trashy, trashy. I thought I could manipulate my way out of this one. I wasn't successful. Obviously. I was sitting in the back of that cop car thinking I was really cute after being up drinking and other things for like 6 weeks straight. I don't think I blinked for a month. And sitting back there thinking, asking him, oh, do you guys surf? You know, what do you do? Hey, you know, thinking I'm going to hook up with them and they're going to let me walk. You know, I didn't do anything wrong. There's nothing. I didn't do anything. I'm just the big victim here, and it's everybody else that does stuff wrong. And they say, oh, we just want to talk to you about some checks. Okay, whatever, you know, playing completely dumb, which was partly an act. I was just really dumb, too. It was easier that way. It was so much easier to be freaking dumb than it was to actually take responsibility for what I was doing. So I was good with that then. So they took me downtown and asked me some questions. They're all, okay, where were you the night before last, blah, 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 blah. So because I wasn't going to put myself in the place where a whole bunch of crazy stuff went down, I just told them I parked in this parking lot and I took my dog for a week for a walk on the beach. And so because I'm not that bright, I just parked in the parking lot of the hotel where all that crap went down. See, I didn't watch enough Matlock or anything when I was younger. So, and they didn't have all this CSI and Criminal Minds and Dexter and all these other things to make me aware of the crap they have to get me. So, oh, I parked here and I went here. And because I adopted the it didn't happen to me or I closed that door and if I don't think about it, it's not real, that became my way of living. If I don't think about it, then it's not true. What a beautiful way of living. It really worked for me for a while. And that day, I was in my element, and I didn't know anything. I just parked here and went for a walk. And so they asked me a few more questions, and then they go into another room where they had my codefendant-to-be in the other room. They come back a couple of hours later, and shit got really serious. Somebody had been killed. And I put myself at the scene of the crime. I was at the scene of the crime when the stuff started to go down. But I got scared, which is my MO. I'm a runner. And when stuff gets too deep, I bail. That's what I do, and that's what I've always done. Oh, too much for me, let me go. And I did that night. And they threw down some pictures of this gentleman who had been killed. And as selfish as I was in that insanity, the only thing I could think about was not this 26-year-old boy who had been murdered, but again, I just thought of myself. And I thought, wow, they're going to kill me too. And I couldn't even think. I couldn't speak. I just lost it. I lost it. And I couldn't talk. And it scared me, and they threw some pictures down of him, and I was terrified. And I didn't talk again for a while. I just blubbered and cried and snotted all over the place. And so they booked me on freaking countless charges I don't even remember. And had and took me to a room where they had a bunch of cops and taken DNA from places I didn't even know you could get DNA from. And really? It's like, wow. And I remember them saying something. And it was really interesting because you learn a different language when you're in prison. They have a whole, there should be like a whole dictionary on that because it's, that I should be able to say I speak two languages. Because what they, because I heard them saying, because I was hysterical at this point, and they kept saying, no, don't mind her, she's kicking. And so in my mind, I'm thinking, first you say I killed somebody, now you're saying I'm kicking everybody. Who the hell do you think you are? I'm not doing anything to anybody. You know, and for some of you guys know what that means. I had no freaking clue. And so again, playing the victim, I know, just crazy. I didn't, it took me a little while, but I learned the lingo. I learned how to survive. So they booked me on murder and torture and robbery and false imprisonment and kidnapping. And God, I can't even remember the rest. But I shut down. That was another addiction of mine, was denial and avoidance. And I could just turn off and stop feeling. And I didn't cry again for a very long time after that. I was in county jail for 9 months. I was facing the death penalty. Mind you, this is pretty much the first time I've had to stay in county jail for more than 2 nights. And they put me in a housing unit with another woman who was facing the death penalty. And, you know, thank God for her, because she really schooled me on the night. She was the nicest person I think I've ever met, but her rap sheet is long. I probably wouldn't have thought that a long time ago, but she, I think she saved my life. She saved my life. She started talking to me about God. Yeah, and I wasn't really listening, but she told the stories in a really cool way. And she was just cool, and she was kind, and she told me how to get by and what to do, and just hold your head up and don't let them ever see any fear. Just don't let them see that. You're tall, you'll be fine. Okay. So 9 months later, I was in county jail for 9 months. Thinking again, I'm the victim. They did it, I didn't. I'm the only one out of three that went to trial. They severed our cases because they didn't want their history to be brought up against mine, whatever, and it still sounds like a good idea to me. So I heard my convictions, and they found me guilty of conspiracy to commit torture. And with a conspiracy law, there's three overt acts. They found me not guilty of beating him and luring him and all these other things, but they found me guilty of driving there. So they found me guilty of conspiracy to commit torture, which carries 7 to life. They also found me guilty of torture because everything that's a natural result of the original conspiracy, and we went there to humiliate him, because that's what I did with men. I embarrassed them when I felt they wronged me. That was what I did, not that I meant to really hurt anybody, but, you know, so that just went along with my thinking. You hurt somebody, then this is what we do. So everything that was a natural result of that conspiracy was torture, so there's life. Second-degree murder, which carries 15 to life. 7 years for false imprisonment and 3 years for robbery. So I was sitting there, and I didn't feel anything. I had no emotion. I was that defendant on the TV that just sat there. And I hear people, when they criticize people that are waiting, you're sitting in court, they're not showing any emotion. Well, what the hell do you want us to do? If we're showing too much, then we're showing too much. You know, it's like, you just get through it. You just do what you freaking do to get through it, and so what my face says. You know, I don't know how to deal with this. So I'm just going to be like cardboard, and that's what I did. I did have my attorney did have me cut bangs. And this is kind of funny, you know, because you got to throw in some funny shit sometimes. He had me cut bangs because he said if the jury saw my eyebrow when my co-defendant got up on the stand, they'd convict me because it looked evil. I'm like, my eyebrow? Really? Is my eyebrow going to get me life in prison and not the crime? Okay, you people are, you got twisted, man. It didn't work. I cut bangs and I still got convicted. So who cares? Cut your hair. Don't cut your hair. I don't give a shit. So that night I went back and again didn't feel anything. And I remember the day I went back, because this happened when, you know, I was on my run. And I was in San Diego. Thank God it didn't happen at home. Or here, because that would have really embarrassed my family. I went back to the pod where we were housed, and this young girl, she was brought over on her 18th birthday, Nikki Martinez, and that was my little bud. And we were both facing capital murder. And I remember walking in, and you know, everything's on the news. Everything's on the news. The picture they had on there was actually really good. And it showed my eyebrow, and it was still a good picture. I thought it made me look very sweet. But she comes up and she just grabs me and cried. And I think of that because she cried for me when I didn't know how to cry for myself. I didn't know how to feel. I didn't know how to do it. It took years before I could feel again. So I went to prison. I went to CIW receiving, and then they opened up Valley State Prison for Women and shipped my butt up there. And I remember getting to prison, you know, and they told me I had less than 1% chance of ever paroling that I would die there. That's what the judge said. Bless his heart. They also, like, compared me to John Wayne Gacy. Don't mistake her looking like a model citizen. You know, look at what he did. And it's like, I don't even have a basement. We're in California. I know. Humor is what helped me survive prison, so I just can't help myself sometimes because sometimes I got to laugh. I can cry, too. I can feel emotion now, and I feel safe in doing that, but sometimes it gets very weighty. No matter how many times I've worked on it or I've looked at it or worked my steps with it, there's still am I deserving of this second chance? Am I deserving of this recovery? Who the hell am I to think that I can have those promises and have this second chance? Who the hell do I think I am? And that's a process. When they say we work the steps for the rest of our life, in the beginning I thought I had to, now I get to. Because it keeps me sane and it keeps me moving forward, because there's still times I wake up and I think, I am so not deserving of this. There's other people that are so much more deserving than what I have now. So I get to prison, and I remember getting off the bus at VSP, and it was brick and dirt. And that was it. But there was this sense of relief. You know, because I finally proved to the world how horrible I really was, and I didn't have to do that anymore. I didn't have to prove to anyone how horrible and rotten I was. That was almost a good feeling. You know, and it makes me sad to think that we can get to a place where prison is a relief. That you can look at me like I'm a monster and I've done monstrous things, but you can look at who I am and think, she needs to die. And think that's okay, that that's who I am, because I'm not my worst act. None of us are. But it's hard to forgive that. It's hard to work through that. And my first couple years in prison, I hung out with the lifers, and they schooled me on everything I needed to do to survive and live in prison, and I was a good student. I could traffic drugs, I could brew hooch, I could manipulate staff. There were a lot of things I learned to do in prison. They even told me that if you ever want to be considered for parole, you got to go to an AA meeting. Now, not because I'm an alcoholic or I have a problem, because you know what? I'm still the only innocent person in prison. I am. I got 3 life sentences, but I didn't do anything wrong. It's everybody else. I'm the victim. It's not me. So the first meeting I went to was an NA meeting, and then after the meeting, I saw the panel beat people up for dope, and I thought, I'm not doing that. Because they were scary and mean. So I went to an AA meeting, and that was like, you know, that was like the old fogey meeting, and it was all relaxed and stuff. But I wasn't an alcoholic. I was there because I wanted the board to say, oh, she's doing something. She's doing something. I got my first meeting there, I was humiliated by one of the people that came in and said that I didn't belong there and that this is just alcoholics and don't talk about anything else. It's like there's no other help, you know, screw you. So that actually pissed me off because I'm very stubborn, and when someone tells me no, I can't do something, yeah, watch me. Yeah, watch me. So I got voted in as secretary. I got all my, you know, peeps in there that were doing a lot of things they shouldn't have been doing. I was like, hey, I need your help. I need to get voted in on this panel, in this AA panel. They're all, hey, what the hell are you talking about? I said, just do it, just do it. So they all showed up, voted me in. So here I am, secretary of an AA meeting in prison. I'm not an alcoholic, and there's nothing wrong with my life. But I'm going to get that little piece of paper saying, look, she's doing something for herself. And it was a couple years sitting on that panel, and I was sitting there one night, and we had this woman come in, Mickey. Oh, she's a love. And I heard my story. For the first time, I heard my story. And it's like, shit. And I sat there, and I'm like, oh, I'm sitting in prison with 3 life sentences. They tell me I'll never go home. You know, I guess my life is a little unmanageable. Maybe I am an alcoholic. You know, and it took a lot of time for me to come to that conclusion. And, you know, when they say, I've read in the big book at one point, you know, when you hit rock bottom, but prison wasn't my bottom. I kept digging. And it wasn't until I stopped digging. And I actually, something sunk in when Mickey shared that it's like, wow. You know, and I remember sitting there at this table and looking out at these people, and some of them are nodding out, just crazy, you know, prison. Well, maybe you don't know. I hope not. And thinking, and it was like I finally saw for the first time. I finally saw it for the first time. So that's my second freedom. I saw things in a totally different way than I had before then. I didn't have those rose-colored glasses on or that, you know, denial mask. It was like, okay, I'm sitting in prison, and it's my responsibility. and I have a problem that I need help with. Okay. So fucking now what? So I had to stop slinging dope, and I had to, like, not have a big, mean girlfriend to fight my battles for me. Because that's, like, the first thing I did when I got there. Yeah, Sarah was really sweet. She was a big Samoan girl, and I loved her to death, and boy, she took really good care of me. Because that's what you got to do. You got to do what you can to survive up in there. She was good people. She really was. We were both lost. But she also taught me a lot, and her friends and her people in there taught me a lot. And I made a lot of friends. I mean, you think it's prison. No. My prison started when I was 12 years old in that fracture. My prison started when I started drinking at 14. That was my life sentence. Going to that gated community with that electric fence and that address was not prison. That was incarceration, and that was God's time out for me. But that wasn't my prison. My prison was my alcoholism. And I didn't become free from that prison until I said, I have a problem and my life's unmanageable. There was my freedom from that prison. And it took a lot of work. We didn't have a lot going on there. There was AA one night and NA another night, and a couple of us on the panel started big book studies. Half the words in that damn book, I don't even know what they mean. So we'd like read a little and it's like, what does that mean? I don't know. We'd spend another 30 minutes trying to figure out what that freaking word meant. Does anybody talk like that anymore? And so we spent a lot of time with that dictionary. And still in some of that stuff, it's like, okay, let's just make something else up. What if sounds good there? But then we came together and we created a real strong recovery community there. Started a 12-step meeting, which, you know, I became what I needed most. I needed to learn the big book, so we started a big book meeting. I needed to work the 12 steps, so we started a 12-step meeting. And eventually, what's crazy, I wasn't that little slut knucklehead from Santa Barbara. I became the AA lady, which, you know, what a turn of events that is. That was crazy. But it was great. Because eventually, I earned the respect of my community. I wasn't straddling the fence anymore. I wasn't that lifer sitting on that panel pretending. It was real for me. It was real. And I loved the 12 steps. And I loved the traditions. And I made that a part of my life. And we were able to start a meeting. And I heard a quote in another workshop. A nonprofit came into the prison. The nonprofit I actually get to work for now came into the prison, and they had a quote by Gandhi. And it was, "Be the change you wish to see in the world." And we started a meeting on the receiving yard at Valley State Prison for Women. And I consider that my home group. I will always consider that my home group. I loved those meetings because those girls were coming into that prison with that same sense of shame and self-loathing. And I was able to sit there and just say, you know, man, there's hope for us. There's hope for us. You're not alone. I was able to give them what Mickey gave me. And I was able to pass it forward, and that helped me in my recovery. Again, my freedom. Alcoholics Anonymous brought me my freedom, and I was able to share that with others, and I wasn't alone. There's nothing like finally waking up and realizing, oh, I'm not the only one. Even after all those years of people saying, you're not the only one, they could have been like, nah, rah, 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 rah. I didn't understand that. I didn't speak that language. Because if you didn't speak to my fracture, I didn't hear anything you were saying. But I finally got to hear, and I finally got to share from a place of, I don't have the answers, but this is what I'm doing, and I can walk with you. I can't walk in front of you. I can't do it for you, but I can walk with you. We can do this together. This isn't about, you know, everything outside. It's about us. And we can do it, and we get to pass it on. And that's where I really became grounded in my recovery, was passing it on. And finally, for the first time in my life, being completely vulnerable and authentic in front of other people. That's where I find my spirituality now. When I can be vulnerable and completely honest, rigorously honest, in front of a room full of people I don't know, I don't get any closer to God than that. I don't get any more grounded in my recovery than that. It doesn't get any better than that. If I don't do that, I stray. I do. And I stray emotionally, and I stray with behaviors. I stray with the insecurities and the self-loathing and the isolation. When I pull back from my program, I'm not okay. I'm not okay. So, obviously, I'm not in prison anymore. I served 18 years. They stayed a couple of my life sentences, so it was 15 to life. My fourth board hearing, I was found suitable for parole. And I used to consider the board my sponsor, because you don't get any more rigorously honest in front of anyone else than you do the board, because you have to talk about everything from when you were an embryo till now, and everything you did, and why, and how you're not going to do it again, and you really have to have a plan for that shit. Sorry. So I was found suitable in April 2012, and I did a lot of work in prison. I did a lot of work because I thought I was going to be there, and I thought the greatest gift I can make amends by helping the women who are going home, because they were going to be near my family. They were going to be driving down the road where my daughter was driving. They were the ones that I needed to be. I needed them to be okay so my family could be okay. So everything I could do supported everything else. And that was my way of making amends, that living amends. And that gave me peace. That supported that inner freedom I found there. It's amazing to be able to find freedom in a place where people don't see any freedom, and they don't see any loving, and they don't see any kindness. And that's really sad, because I met some of the most beautiful spirits when I was there, some of the best people that changed my life and saved my life were there. My friends, my family, the people that I love and the people that I miss very much are still there. So I was speaking to our niece last night, and we were sharing about a few things, and we were talking about, she was asking me what it was like for my daughter when I was there, and how was I able to talk to her. And I remember when she was 12 years old, she asked me, she's like, "Mommy, when are you coming home?" You know, she's 12. She wants to know when Mommy's coming home. And you know, there's a lot of things you can't explain to a child, but it's important to be as honest as possible, because they know. And I don't want to continue that cycle of trying to keep you safe by not telling you the truth, because, you know, that had me go ass backwards. So I told her, I said, "Honey, you'll probably be bringing your children here to visit me," because I couldn't have her waiting for me, and I couldn't lie to her. You know, I met women who said, "Oh, they tell their children they're at school." Well, that's really not going to help them when they want to go to school, because I know I wouldn't want to go to school after that. You know, when you're going to school and I never get to see you, what the hell is that all about? Yeah, I think that could really backfire. So I remember telling her that, and then I also remembered, because we were talking about some other fears, and when she came to tell me she was pregnant, this was in beginning of 2012, she came to tell me she was going to have a baby. My baby was going to have a baby. And I was so excited. But I also remember her telling me, she said, "Mommy, I'll never bring my child here. I can't do that." And of course I understand that. Did it hurt? Yeah. But I get it. And so I need my daughter to always feel safe in being honest with me, without fear that I'm going to be upset or angry or stop loving her. So I get it. Was it emotional? Yeah, it was emotional for her. So we had that conversation. And so part of the reason I want to share that is because when we talk about the promises that are so freaking out of reach, sometime when we're in the program, "Oh, it sounds great for other people. That's never going to happen to me." Well, it does happen. I still don't believe it, but it happens. And I paroled September 18th, 2012. So that's been under 4 years. I'm still on freaking parole. Whatever. A lot better off than I was. So I paroled, and my grandson was 3 months old, and I got to hold him that day. So my grandson never has to know me in my drinking, in my addictions, in my lying, in my cheating, in my insecurity. He never has to see me in prison. He never has to see me in prison. And what a gift that is. I got to hold him. And I got out the day before my daughter's birthday. So how freaking cool is that? I spent 18 years there, and I thought I was going to die there. And I think a part of me did. The part of me that I needed to let go. And I let that go. Not saying that when we let go, it's not like a rubber band and doesn't slap us upside the head sometimes. But when that rubber band comes up and slaps me upside the head, I have the skills and I have the steps that will help me deal with that pain, that will help me walk through it. Because never again do I want to put the people I love through that. And I know I won't survive it. I know we're supposed to put ego aside, but my ego wouldn't survive it. There'd be no way. There'd be no way I could walk back in here. That keeps me sober when I get really low. And it's like, wow, look at that bar. And I always chat. I was like, oh, there's my bar. It's like this freaking dive bar in Fresno or Fillmore. And I always clown. And I can honestly say, to be completely candid, my husband's sitting right here, that there's moments where it's like, God, I wonder what it would be like to go in there. Am I really fooling myself that I won't drink if I walk up into that place? For one, I'll probably be the only white girl. And I like that shit. That's fun to me. It's like, that's a challenge. Well, let me show you. But do I really think that I could walk into a place like that and walk out fully solid in my recovery? I'd like to think I could. But that's a crock. The fact that I'm even like slightly, a little bit entertaining the idea of, wow, that would be fun to walk in there. I'm not saying that I'm thinking about drinking now, that, oh, it'd be fun to drink. No, that'd be fun to walk in there. And then it just becomes a little closer. Oh, it'd be fun to do this. Oh, just one drink. I've been sober a long time. I've worked my skill. I've worked my steps. I'm fine. I can handle a shot of vodka or Cuervo or something. Not a problem. Really? Mm-mm. Because even if by chance, small chance, that were true, and I could have a drink and walk away and be okay, the chance that that isn't true is much greater. And I know when I'm drinking and I'm not in control, people die. Somebody died. And that would be dishonoring his mother and his family and everyone else who has lost their life to this disease, whether they were drinking or their life was taken by somebody in this disease. So those are the people I think about. And it pulls me right back. And I think about that day I got arrested in that beer that I didn't want to spill when that was the only thing that mattered to me? No. I've been out for less than 4 years. I got married in December to a fabulous man in the program. The promises. Because I didn't think men my age dated women my age. And mostly that's true. Right, guys? Yeah. That's okay. I get it. I know. Because, you know, I get it. I get it. So I was blessed, and I always say God saved him just for me. I'm also in a position now that we bought a home, and that was my dream. That was my goal. I wanted to buy a home because I wanted my grandson to have a place where he could have those memories that I had when I was little. I want him to say, oh, I'm going to go to Grandma Lama's house. And he lives up in Washington, and so we only see him once or twice a year. But the last time he visited me, he stood in the sliding glass door and said, I don't want to leave Fillmore. I mean, whoever said that? I know, huh? That's pretty cool. Grandma's house must be a lot of fun if he doesn't want to leave Fillmore for Washington. That's all green and wet. But I have that place, and I have an amazing life. But I also have to stay connected to my program because there's plenty of times where I still don't think I'm deserving of it. And that is the slippery slope for me. Is thinking I'm not good enough and I don't deserve this, and allowing myself to fall into that depression and not catching it. Saying, you know what? And what helps me catch it is this. You know, I haven't spoken at a meeting for a really long time, and I don't know why. Because that disease is powerful, and it wants to keep me away from what keeps me free. It wants to keep me away from what keeps me free. And it's not parole or any of those people. It's my program. It's the 12 steps. It's the traditions that keep me free. Because that's the true prison. That's the true prison. So I'm out. I actually work for a nonprofit that goes into the prisons. So I keep I'm able to give back. I just got approval to go into Valley State, which is now a men's prison, which I don't know what they do, just add a couple of urinals and then call it a day. I don't know what they did with that. So I get to go back in there because we started a weekly program there, and I get to go back in. I get to go back in prison. I mean, who says that? I have been dying to get back into prison as a volunteer. And not as an inmate. I don't want to do that because, you know, I like wearing tights and not blues. But I get to go back in. I've been back. About 7 months or so after I got out, I was asked to speak at CCWF at the women's prison. I was asked to go back in. And people aren't you scared? They're not going to let you out? I'm like, no, because I'm not doing all that shit I used to do. So why would they keep me? So it's really easy. If I'm doing the right thing and I'm following my steps and I'm staying sober and I'm working my amends, I'm going to stay free. But it's work. It's always work. And in the beginning of my AA career, I thought, I got to do this. I have to do this. It used to irritate me. When people say, well, no, you have to work this step and you have to continue. Damn it, really? I have to do this? But now I get to do this. This is a privilege. To be with all of you tonight and having this opportunity to be of service is a privilege, and it helps keep me sober. And I just want to say thank you, and anything is possible in this program. So thank you very much.